Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I am Mark Brody. In Valley traffic on the 202 northbound the Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at University has the right lane blocked. 143 southbound, an accident is blocking the University Drive on-ramp. And on the 101 eastbound, an accident has the shoulder blocked at 19th Avenue. Sunny skies in the Valley forecast for tomorrow. Look for a high of 85, warmer than today, warming up to 90 on Sunday.
The Arizona Supreme Court is on the verge of getting bigger. HB 2537 is advancing in the state legislature. If majorities pass the bill and Governor Doug Ducey signs it, then he'd have the power to appoint two new members to the state high court. That would expand the court from five to seven justices. Negotiations are also underway on a more expansive package that would include raising salaries for justices and some other judges. Glenn Hammer is president and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry, which is supportive of the legislation.
Arizona is now a much larger state than it was even 10 or 20 years ago. We're the 14th largest state in the country. We just passed Massachusetts in terms of population. The court is actually built for seven justices, and we believe that we would get more written decisions, particularly in civil cases, if the court were expanded to seven justices.
Are we in a situation now where you think the court is not accepting enough cases because the caseload would be too big and that would sort of be filtered out by adding two?
We believe that we would have, there would simply be more capacity for more written decisions, particularly in civil cases, if the court were expanded. It's just simple math. Five human beings could do so much work. Seven could do more.
Glenn, there are some critics who are going to point out the fact that the chamber's been very supportive of Governor Ducey. And what about maybe having one while Governor Ducey's in office, and then maybe adding a seventh when whoever the next governor might be, or if Governor Ducey wins a second term?
There is a package pending that there is the possibility to get additional justices to the court, as well as additional pay. And I'll just say the chamber also very strongly supports additional pay for our judges and justices. We want to make sure we can attract and retain the best and the brightest. And to me, the perfect equation here is let's go to a Supreme Court of seven and let's get some more dollars to our judges.
Would the two, again, have to happen as soon as possible legislation is signed, or could we stagger those in some way?
The reason why I would want two at once is that I do believe it would be useful to keep an odd number. You know, we're seeing with the U.S. Supreme Court now, with the unfortunate passing of Justice Scalia, some ties that are coming up. I believe it would serve the state much better to still have that odd number. And seven's a very reasonable number. And again, Steve, an important point to stress again is that we have a merit selection process here. I mean, it's a very serious, detailed process for the governor to get to consider any judge or justice. And I believe, you know, Chief Justice Bales has also pointed out that Governor Ducey has made about 17 appointments all told, and they've all been of the highest quality. So we feel very comfortable with, if this were to pass, for Governor Ducey to make two additional appointments.
Glenn Hammer is President and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Glenn, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show, Steve.
Critics wonder whether there really is a need for two more justices on Arizona's high court. ASU law professor Paul Bender is skeptical.
As far as I can tell, there is absolutely no need for that. A lot of people think that courts like that can do more business more efficiently if they have more justices, but that's exactly wrong. It's the opposite. The more justices you have, the harder it is to do business because you have to get seven people to agree on things or seven people who used to talk about things. So I'm not aware that they have a big backlog. I'm not aware of any reason why the court would need two more justices.
Considering how a majority, at least, of people in Arizona consider merit selection to have been a good system and still a good system, if, in fact, this legislation were to go through, do you have any concerns that people who would be chosen for those two extra seats would not be qualified?
No, not that they would not be qualified, because the merit selection system, I don't think it's been running recently quite as well as it did at the beginning when we got a whole bunch of really star judges out of it. We still get some very good people. And, you know, they will filter out people who are not qualified. So I have no reason to think that the next two nominees to the court wouldn't be as qualified as past people have been. What I'm afraid of is that when I think of why is this being done, it's hard to think of a reason, but one possible reason is that it's being done to give the current governor a chance to make two more appointments to the court in his first term. And if that's why it's being done, and if he's involved in it in any way, then what would trouble me was that it was being done for political reasons.
Well, there are some critics who've said that based on the makeup of the legislature, if Janet Napolitano or Fred DeVal were governor, this would have no chance of making it through.
That's probably true. If you think that, then you think that this is a political thing to do, and that's not what ought to happen. I don't care who's the governor. You shouldn't be enlarging the court unless there's a need for it. And even if there's a need, I think it's a mistake to do it all at once. If you needed two more justices, Governor Ducey's just had one appointment. I would phase it in over a couple of years. You know, give him another appointment in a couple of years and another appointment after that, so that you don't give one governor a chance to appoint more than half the court.
When I interviewed Rebecca White Birch just before she retired, she pointed out the statistics that indicated there were many unanimous, whether someone had been appointed by a Democrat or Republican, whatnot. Do you think it's a competent court that if we kept these five, at least until one was forced to retire, this would be a good representative court for Arizona?
I think it's a perfectly good court. There's no reason to think that it needs some changes in the membership. And I think you point out a way in which the Arizona Supreme Court is, I think, been a very good court, and that is so many of the decisions are unanimous. And two, you can't tell when you read these opinions who's a Democrat and who's a Republican. They don't split along those lines. They don't talk that way when they decide cases, or at least they haven't since the merit selection system went into play. And that's a very valuable thing to keep, to have a non-political court.
Paul Bender, ASU law professor and former U.S. Deputy Solicitor General.
In 2010, President Obama issued a presidential memorandum, and for the first time, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people and their families were guaranteed the right to visit their family members in the hospital. It came after Janice Langben was kept away from her partner's hospital room when she died.
When these kinds of things happen, it makes a hospital realize, oh, we have a problem.
Tari Hanneman is the author of the Human Rights Campaign Foundation Healthcare Equality Index, which measures hospitals and healthcare facilities nationwide on their policies and practices for LGBT patients.
Most people in healthcare, I think, don't want to be providing bad care. They want to, you know, be providing the best patient-centered care that they can. And so they just don't always have the policies and procedures in place, or they haven't trained their staff how to do that.
KJZZ's Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about this, and she joins me. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Mark.
So the Human Rights Campaign surveyed hospitals all over the country about this. How did Arizona do?
So they've actually been doing this survey since 2007, and Hanneman says she's seen some improvement in Arizona hospitals. This year, five hospitals and healthcare facilities here were recognized as leaders in LGBT healthcare equality, and many of the larger healthcare providers that are here, like Banner and Mayo Clinic, she said, have system-wide non-discrimination policies.
So what are they looking for in the survey?
So the survey looks for a hospital's patient and employee non-discrimination policies, employee training on these issues, and their visitation policies. But Hanneman says since the president's 2010 action, most healthcare facilities nationwide have changed their policies on visitation because those new regulations were tied to Medicare and Medicaid funding.
So any healthcare facility that wants Medicaid money, which is pretty much all of them, has to allow patients to have the visitors of their choice, and they are not allowed to discriminate based on sexual orientation or gender identity.
But she says healthcare discrimination against the LGBT community doesn't stop there.
We independently researched almost 1,000 hospitals around the country to look to see if they had three key policies, visitation being one, patient non-discrimination being a second one, and then employment non-discrimination being the third key policy. And we found that only 56% of the hospitals where we found a policy, we found a policy that says this hospital will not discriminate against you because of XYZ, you know, race, sex, gender, religion, all of those, but they did not include sexual orientation and gender identity.
Now the Human Rights Campaign is asking for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to do the same thing they did with visitation, with patient non-discrimination. They want to make it a condition of participation in Medicare and Medicaid that hospitals cannot discriminate against somebody because of their sexual orientation or gender identity.
Well, what are some of the things hospitals are trying to do to be more inclusive to LGBT people?
So Hanneman says it often starts with really little things that hospitals don't even think of sometimes, like the language on an intake form or misgendering or misnaming someone who's transgender. But she says the most important thing a hospital can do is to create a welcoming, inclusive environment.
I've had some hospital executives say to me, you know, well, We maybe have some of the L's and the G's, but I don't think we have any of the B's and the T's, meaning they didn't have any bisexual or transgender patients. And I would, you know, my response was, I think you probably do. You just don't know it because they're afraid to tell you. And, you know, a healthcare setting is not a place where people need to be afraid. And so it leads to people not coming out to their providers or not even going to a provider if they fear they're not going to be welcomed as who they are.
That was Tari Hanneman, author of the Human Rights Campaign Foundation's Healthcare Equality Index, which evaluates healthcare facilities' policies and practices related to the equity of LGBT employees, patients, and their families.
And that's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Mark.
The State Board of Education has done the math. Arizona needs more teachers for Algebra 1 and 2 classes, but some of those potential instructors have not been able to show proficiency in subjects like trigonometry and calculus, so a new test is being implemented. Joe Thomas, Vice President of the Arizona Education Association, joins me to talk about that. Joe, do you think modifying the test for potential math teachers is a good step?
We've seen social studies and the sciences already go in this direction. I teach social studies at the high school level. And I didn't have to take a test over economics, and I don't test economics. I took a test over U.S. history, over U.S. government, over world history, and those are the areas that I'm certificated to teach in. If my school district wants me to teach economics, I would have to go back and take that test, and I should. And so it allows for a little bit more of a tailoring or an alignment for teachers so they can line up the areas that they pass a test into the areas that they teach. And that fundamental principle is what we really believe in, is you can't just put someone in a classroom. You have to have someone that knows the content, and you have to have someone that understands pedagogy or how to teach students.
It also comes to mind for me the re-emphasis on STEM, certainly, and as a way to not only improve K-12, but also this idea that it's going to make Arizona students even more ready to compete on a global basis. Do you think that could be part of the reason why we're hearing more emphasis about trying to find math teachers who fit a different position? Maybe that would apply to science teachers as well?
I don't know if our focus on STEM came before the struggle to find math and science teachers or is a result of the struggle to find math and science teachers. You know, it's almost like the chicken and the egg. Mm-hmm. We need good people in all of our classrooms. If you major in English, I don't know what options are out there for you. If you major in math, well, there's all sorts of options out there for you beyond teaching math. If you major in science, well, there's even more that I can think of that are options. So to get good teachers into math and science classrooms, we have to be competitive with pay. We have to be competitive with our working conditions. And so I think that struggle to find the really good math and science teachers to fill our classrooms only increased when all of the teachers became harder to find, and that's, you know, due to our last place investment from the state.
When we consider changing the testing standards for math teachers, is that a path toward lowering qualifications and, in fact, lowering the standards of what Arizona's education system should be like?
Well, let me give you this example.
Okay.
If I tested a student over the history of the world when I'm really only teaching them U.S. history, you don't have a good alignment there. So I see some flexibility and some tailoring of these professional tests for teachers as a positive, and it aligns them with the courses that they want to teach. Again, science has already done this. Social studies has already done this. I don't see that we've had a drop-off in our scores related to those areas. I don't think we've seen teachers that don't want to teach here because they feel like their Arizona teachers aren't professional. So I see it as a benefit to the teacher. I see it as flexibility for the school. And so I don't see a lowering of standards at all.
Joe Thomas is Vice President of the Arizona Education Association. Joe, thank you for the time.
No, thank you, sir.
Under the new standard, math teachers who are teaching lower-level classes will not have to show they're also proficient in subjects like trig and calculus. Charles Tack is with the Arizona Education Department, and he joins me. So, Charles, what went into the decision to make this change?
We have a significant teacher shortage across the state, and one of the areas that has been impacted by that shortage in particular is mathematics teachers. And so the idea behind this change is twofold, really, to help make it easier for qualified math teachers to teach the lower level math that they're qualified to teach, and at the same time ensure that regardless of the subject, a teacher that's in a classroom teaching mathematics has the content mastery to effectively teach the students.
Are you finding that you're having more trouble filling teaching positions in some of those lower level classes as opposed to like trigonometry, calculus, things like that?
Well, it really works out to a numbers game because when you think about high schools across our state, because the requirements for high school graduation go through Algebra 2, that's really where every high school has to have teachers that are able to teach that subject to all of their students. And so you have fewer students that are progressing on beyond Algebra 2 to the trigonometry, to the pre-calculus and the calculus. And so again, it really does become a numbers game. You need more teachers to be able to get every student access to those lower level classes. And so that is an area where you see more of a shortage simply because you need more of those teachers to cover those subjects.
Does the Department of Education see this change as the answer or part of the answer?
Oh, certainly it's not the only answer. It's part of several solutions that we've been looking into and will continue to look into.
One of the things that we hear a lot from teachers, and Superintendent Douglas has mentioned this quite a bit as well, which is teacher salaries. And I'm curious where you think that falls in terms of recruiting and retaining math teachers as opposed to some of the other strategies that you're doing, including changing the testing standards.
Oh, well, I think the salary issue is probably the top issue. When it comes right down to it, if a teacher can't afford to support themselves and support their family, they're going to look elsewhere.
Are there other states that have done the same kind of thing that Arizona has done as far as reducing the standard somewhat in an effort to keep and get math teachers?
Well, we know that there are other states that have a similar model where you'll see subjects like math and science that are divided up by the subject area that the teacher will be teaching. And in Arizona, until this change was made, at least in mathematics, that was not the case.
Charles Tack with the Arizona Department of Education. Charles, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Mark. You have a good one.
The Phoenix-based performance group Radio Healer creates unique musical experiences with instruments hacked from obsolete electronic gadgets. They blend familiar and unfamiliar sounds in an attempt to challenge ideas like old and new, primitive and advanced. The show's Jimmy Jenkins dials us in.
This is very simple, like a traditional kind of noise box. It's just a box with a bunch of knobs and buttons.
Cristobal Martinez is playing the Beast, a silver-spiked metal box with knobs that's hooked up to an amplifier. It's one of many musical instruments he's made from old electronics and recycled parts. He picks up a synthesizer made from mailing tubes and old computer speakers.
And now I can remove the tube cap, and I can use the tube cap as a way to modulate the sound. And then I've got some photo cells here, so it kind of plays like a theremin.
Another instrument is fashioned from a controller for an old golfing video game with joysticks connected to pulleys and strings. It might seem obsolete to most of us, but after Martinez hacked it, it's become almost a sonic marionette.
You can control the filter of a tone by pulling on these strings. You pull on these strings in a different direction, you can change the pitch.
On their own, these instruments may not seem musical, but together they become something more complex. Martinez works with the three other members of his group to build layers of sound, playing the hacked electronics as well as more traditional indigenous instruments like a tone block and an ayoyote rattle. Radio Healer is an improvised performance that's been adapted from traditional Native American healing ceremonies. Martinez says the concepts of adaptive reuse and sustainability are extensions of the group's indigenous heritage.
We're using those knowledge systems as a framework for hacking these new media technologies.
The performance is both musical and visual, as the music drones, black and white images of barren strip malls and desolate urban landscapes are projected on a screen. Radio Healer member Edgar Cardenas hopes the images and sounds challenge their audience to think about their relationship with society. He says performing allows him to tune out the white noise of advertising and commercialism.
You stop becoming merely a consumer of the technology that's mediated for you, and you start actually being the producer.
Raven Kemp is the youngest member of the group. He's experienced life on the Navajo reservation and now lives in Phoenix.
I feel like staying here in the city and having those kinds of instruments kind of feels like having the reservation here.
He says cracking open computers and soldering circuit boards has led to even more questions about the inner workings of the world around him.
You know, that's what this group has taught me, is to take apart all I've known and rework it as something else.
Martinez likens his group's experimental approach to the bold ingenuity of Chicano lowrider culture.
Hack the car, reimagine the car, and create a whole new type of ride, a whole new type of experience. And in doing that, you create a tool for hacking the rules of the road, which is essentially to get the traffic to slow down.
And that's what Radio Healer would like their audience to do too. Slow down, tune in, and listen. For the show, I'm Jimmy Jenkins.
Pre-flight checklist. Two pennies gleaming mercury, a map sewn into your coat's lining, sachets of spring flowers in your fists for queens on vacation. The dirt rolls open. Your flight is boarding.
That was one of the micro poems that'll be in a new zine from Rinky Dink Press. The poems are all 35 words max. Each of the 10 authors in the collection will have 6 poems all on one sheet of paper. Rosemary Dombrowski is a lecturer on ASU's downtown campus, as well as the founder and editor of Rinky Dink Press.
We have these ongoing conversations about the palatability of poetry, about the readability of poetry, about who we're actually reaching, who finds it accessible and who doesn't. It's not that I don't appreciate an academic audience, but once you have an academic audience, you've reached your limit with your academic audience. So your audience doesn't grow from there. And I think writers today are concerned with reaching out beyond that community so that they can have pseudo-writing careers. And we thought that micro-poetry disseminated as a micro-zine was one way to do that.
Is it a fair comparison to say that micro-poetry is kind of like the Twitter version of poetry?
You know what? I think it's been called that. It's been compared to that.
Is that considered okay? I mean, is it derogatory to say that?
You know, I don't think it's necessarily derogatory. I have read some Twitter poetry, and some of it is pretty good. But I would probably say that there's not the same attention to craft there in Twitter poetry.
Is it in some ways harder to write a poem that's only 35 words max, knowing that you don't have lines upon lines to really get across what you're trying to get across?
I think so, absolutely. When students come into my poetry workshops from a fiction workshop, not having written poetry before, one of their initial struggles is simply acclimating to verse form. Poems are compact packages as they are when they're 30 lines or 50 lines. So I think micro poetry is extremely challenging because poetry is challenging for most writers.
So it sounds like the zine that you produce is something that one could theoretically fit in their pocket. Is that right?
Absolutely. A shirt pocket.
A shirt pocket.
It's about that size.
Where on my shirt pocket,
yes.
Where my pen is currently residing.
Yes, it would fit in there perfectly. It's maybe slightly bigger than a wallet or about the same size as a wallet.
Are you hoping that people will, like, take these around and, like, take them out of their pockets and show them to people? Is it a better distribution model?
I think it is. We're talking about dropping all 10 collections that we're going to launch in Series 1 into manila envelopes and sending them to both coasts, selling the bundle for $5. We feel like that way everybody will have something within that group that they find appealing. I think there's going to be a little bit of something for everyone in there.
Who is submitting these?
Well, we sent out calls for submissions to several creative writing programs across the country, and we got a decent amount of responses from the East Coast primarily, and we were happy with that. We also sent solicitations out to some local writers whose work we've seen published in other journals, who we've seen read locally.
Did you find that there was a lot of diversity in terms of how these micro poems were structured?
Absolutely. Some are extremely narrative and interlinked, meaning that the sections don't stand alone that well. And you really do need to read all six to get the full effect. They're punchy, they're witty, they're funny. Others are very ethereal, they're very lyrical, they're very imagistic. Some did tend more toward nature imagery, and those definitely read more like haiku, though we didn't necessarily publish all of those. Some were from younger writers, older writers. The male and female styles are very different.
How about the cadence? I mean, when you're working in such a small number of words, is there room for different types of cadence in these poems?
I think so. The prose pieces definitely read differently because we're talking about something that goes to maybe the mid-page, a sentence that goes to the mid-page, a line that goes to the mid-page. You're forced to read that like a sentence and not like a line that's broken in what would seem to the average reader or the casual reader a strange place. So I think they all have different sound qualities, certainly all thematically very different. Again, some are going to feel very zine-like. They're crazy, they're kooky, they're witty, they're funny. And others are going to feel like they're really of that kind of journalistic quality, like, oh, this should be in some sort of MFA journal affiliated with the university. And I think that basically represents the editorial board's range of proclivities.
Rosemary Dombrowski is the founder and editor of Rinky Dink Press. It'll be launching Series 1 of its micro poem zine later this month, and you can hear some more of the micro poems at theshow.kjzz.org. The Hopi language only became a written one in 1998, and now a language teacher on the Hopi Reservation has written a pair of children's books in both English and Hopi. Anita Poliala's books are called Celebrate My Hopi Corn and Celebrate My Hopi Toys, and she joins me. So, Anita, why write kids' books in both languages?
My purpose is language learning. Our language is slowly going away. We do not have very many fluent speakers, and I've been working to stabilize it, revitalize what we have. And I know that as a Hopi, one of the essentials to my well-being is this language.
Well, so is the hope then that by having children's books and getting younger kids involved in reading this language that they will continue and carry that through the rest of their lives?
Yes, and to pick up the language to, and not just the language, but to it, there's so much more to read in the stories, just like the toys. Some of these games we do not play. Some of the toys are not available right here. We don't play with the toys as often, so that not just learning the language, but it's also learning what we have, and we can still have that. It's enjoyable.
Do you find that parents are well versed enough, both in sort of the cultural history as well as the language, to be reading the books with their kids and to be talking about some of the messages and the lessons with their kids?
It's quite interesting by experience from observing when children come to look at the books and they're all excited. The grandparents, there's probably my generation of the last fluent speakers. Our younger parents are not fluent speakers. They've lost many of these games, many of these stories, lessons that come within these. So it's a fun way to bring about, get people excited, get our people excited into what can be.
Anita Poliala teaches Hopi language on the Hopi Reservation. She's also the author of two books in both English and Hopi called Celebrate My Hopi Corn and Celebrate My Hopi Toys.
Being a comedian already comes with a few significant challenges. You better be funny and know how to tell a joke. If those qualities aren't in play, you're probably going to experience the indignity of being heckled by a crowd. But what if you've got even deeper things to deal with?
Also, I gotta tell you, I got 99 problems and palsy is just one. If there was an oppression Olympics, I would win the gold medal. I'm Palestinian, Muslim, I'm female, I'm disabled, and I live in New Jersey.
That's Maysoon Zayed from a popular TED Talk she gave in 2013. Her stand-up comedy career continues, and she recently added the title Comedian in Residence at Arizona State University to her resume. Maysoon, you are so self-deprecating. Have you ever run into an audience that was uncomfortable laughing at your material?
So I think it's really interesting that I came up in New York comedy clubs where the audience have very little sympathy. And honestly, when I started doing stand-up comedy, the fact I had a disability wasn't really on my radar as something that people would react to or that would be negative, because I was a Palestinian Muslim comedian doing comedy post 9/11 in New York City. So the fact that I was Arab, female, and Muslim was a much bigger deal than the fact that I had a disability. And honestly, my disability didn't really come into play as a negative thing with my audiences or in my comedy until after I did my TED Talk. And then after I did my TED Talk and I became kind of the disabled J-Lo, that's when people started being uncomfortable laughing at stuff that was otherwise kind of my way of making disability relatable and humanizing it.
You were not allowed to be that kid who could worry about having a disability. You needed to do everything that everyone else was doing. But was there a feeling that people did look at you differently, and did that affect you in some way?
No, I do not know why, but I was never treated differently. And I've had the same friends since I was 5 years old, and they're my friends now. And I ask them all the time, why didn't you make fun of me? And they said, you were just Mimi. We grew up with you. We saw you all the time. And it didn't register to them as a negative. And I understand that I'm lucky and that that's not the experience that so many other people my age have. And it's definitely not the experience that college students and teenagers and kids with disabilities are experiencing today. And when I have people with disabilities reach out to me and talk about the fact that they're stared at, pointed at, bullied, dehumanized, it's so shocking to me because somehow I managed to escape that scathing behavior until I became a public figure.
Now, you've expanded beyond the comedian in residence. You're giving advice to ASU students in this great series of videos. And some of these are very serious questions. How do you deal with whatever? Are you making a point of trying to make people laugh with that, or just trying to be a great advice giver?
I'm making a point of trying to make people laugh. And sometimes I wonder if there should be a huge disclaimer that says, don't actually take this advice. Some of it is really sincere. Some of it is just pure comedy. But I love advice you don't want to hear for a couple of reasons. One is because it's my triumphant return to ASU. When I went to ASU, I was such a drama queen. I joke in advice you don't want to hear that we film in my traditional weeping spots. And I want people to not be like me. I want people to not take themselves so seriously. I want them to have fun in college and learn in college.
I've got to come back to the one answer, which I probably shouldn't have laughed at as hard as I did, but the question about whether how much hair and how often women should shave. Oh, my God.
Everybody loves that shaving.
Well, because
story.
It's...
I really like...
I thought you were trying to kill yourself. You
so
cut
the,
yourself.
The shaving story is 100% true.
Now it's time for Maysoon's shaving story. When I was a sophomore at Arizona State University, I was in my sweet shower shaving. And I went to rinse the razor, and there was a 7-inch piece of skin. When I looked down, the blood was squirting everywhere. I don't like blood, so I passed out cold and covered the drain in the shower at McClintock Hall. I flooded the entire third floor. The water went over the balcony like a waterfall. And when people came in and found me bleeding in the shower, they thought I had tried to kill myself. As they carried me naked, wrapped in a towel, to the nearest car, they said, "Maysoon, why? Why did you do it?" And I said, "I just wanted to be sexy."
And I have never, ever shaved my legs since, but wax is my friend.
Now you know why I feel badly about laughing about that one, because people thought you tried to commit suicide, so that's not always fun.
They did. They did. That day was a very not funny day, but looking back at it, I think it's all hilarious.
Now, Mason, did you think that you were a funny person?
I became a comedian because when I turned on the TV, I didn't see people who look like me. I'm a person of color, I'm not considered skinny, and I have a visible disability, cerebral palsy, where I shake all the time. So the people who did most resemble me were the comedians. And I got into comedy because I thought it was my way into entertainment. And I didn't know I was funny. I didn't know what it took. And I signed up for a class at Caroline's Comedy Club. And I just, you know, dove in head first. And lucky for me, I definitely have a way with comedy. So I told my students, like, you can learn how to be funny. But there are some people who are more inherently funny than others. And I'm inherently funny, but I had no idea until I started studying comedy.
Maysoon Zayed is ASU's comedian in residence.
We all know Superman is a journalist by day and a superhero off the clock. Well, the Valley has a person in a somewhat similar situation, a utility worker by day and a strongman after hours. The show's Annika Klein tagged along on his daily routine.
Jerry Pritchett starts his day here, in a garage at SRP's East Valley Service Center. Heavy metal blasts from the stereo, while Pritchett cuts and welds another kind of heavy metal. He's a metal fabricator for the utility company.
I work on all the vehicles, do fab work for the line crew, building tools and boxes, and then fixing transformers and things like that.
Then in the afternoon, Pritchett goes from cutting metal to lifting it. Pritchett's a strong man. He competes around the world, including in the World's Strongest Man for the past 4 years.
For strongman or strength athletics, it's our Super Bowl, our Indianapolis 500, you know, any of your biggest thing of every sport, World's Strongest Man is ours.
This is his personal training facility, because you don't find dumbbells made with tires at the local gym. There are metal kegs and sandbags and Atlas stones, 380-pound spheres that are lifted onto a platform. Pritchett says you have to train to the events if you want to win.
I do those events every week to make sure that I'm efficient in them.
This is where the metal fabrication background comes in handy. All this special equipment here, Pritchett made most of it himself.
If there's a show coming up and they have some kind of odd, you know, something we haven't seen before, I can try to get the dimensions of it and copy it so I have it to train with.
In last year's Worlds competition in Malaysia, Pritchett had to pull an 1,100-pound yoke, like what a pair of oxen would wear to pull a loaded wagon. Only Pritchett was pulling 6 college students sitting on either side. He took 10th place, which means he just got into the finals. And of the 10 guys standing on the platform, he was the only one with a job. If you don't have a lot of sponsors, the sport is not cheap.
My wife and I went broke for a long time doing it. I've been fortunate enough here the last couple of years where I picked up enough good sponsors.
But he's not about to quit his day job. He's still putting in a lot more money than he's getting back. And that's really appreciated by the other guys who use his training facility, like Easton Taylor.
He's one of the biggest promoters in Arizona for Arizona Strongman. So last year he put on 2 shows, and that allows people to come out from different states and actually cut their teeth and, you know, see if they want to do Strongman.
And they're always working toward that next show, the next peak to climb.
It just makes everything like we do right now, like, you know, all the thankless hours of sweating through training and bleeding through training, you know, if you can actually have a great show or have a great lift, that's your payday. That makes it worthwhile.
The next goal for Pritchett, to be World's Strongest Man 2016. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.